Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Webb, and with me are Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
And Dixie Cochran.
Yeah, I guess I'm here. Hi.
In spirit, if not in body.
I hope you're here because you're going to be my co-host for the interview coming up today. And if you're not there, then I have to do it by myself.
You can do it by yourself. You'd be fine.
I don't know. Today we're interviewing Steve Kenson. He's a legend in this industry. I mean, he's done so many projects, a lot of superhero projects, but also seminal games like Blue Rose. He's worked on Shadowrun. He's written novels. He's done a lot in the past 20 years as a self-employed freelancer, and that can be pretty intimidating. So having someone there in that interview to help me would be very helpful.
I guess I'll come help you out.
Eddie, as long as you don't flub the introduction, because that's the most important thing, that when you do the link from here to there, if you come across as a complete oaf, I don't think I'll ever be able to look you in the eye again.
Okay, well good. That doesn't make me nervous at all. I'm sure I'll be very calm and comfortable as I do that.
Eddie, you're always so calm and comfortable. Calm, comforting problem.
I don't think you've met me. Calm and comfortable is not really my wheelhouse.
Doppelganger,
yes. You could tell it's not really me if I'm actually acting calm and collected. Shoot me in the head, I'm probably a replacement.
Okay. You twisted my arm.
Speaking of being shot in the head, no.
This is violent. I don't like it.
Right. Well, it is aberrant. I mean, you know, we are talking about our superhero game, which is now on Kickstarter at the time this is going live.
Yay, aberrant!
Although the time of recording, it's hopefully going live in a few hours. We haven't heard if Kickstarter's actually approved it yet, so it's going to be interesting.
Everybody else, let's try not to date this, you know, just in case.
Right, I know. I know. I'm excellent at this. I'm great at taking my own advice. See, also calm and collected.
I think we went through last week's episode without dating it at all. And that is the first one in probably 20 episodes where we haven't done that. So it feels comforting to be back in the on the jaggedy path where we're dating everything we're doing badly.
No, that's fair. We had a super serious episode and we want to make sure, okay, we're all like on our A game and trying to be respectful of the topic and blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, okay, yeah, now it's just an interview with Steve so we can kick back and fuck up the intro. It'd be fine.
This will be fun though. I've never actually talked to Steve. I've met him kind of in passing at like Gen Con. But we've never really spoken. So yeah, this will be cool.
Well, let's go ahead and get started with that then. And we're out from the intro. We haven't figured this out yet, ever, have we? How to do this right?
Welcome to the interview portion of the podcast. Interview. I don't know.
I don't even know. I'm here with Dixie. Today we are interviewing Steve Kenson, who's done a ton with the industry. It's really hard to encapsulate his accomplishments, but he's been working in the industry since 1995 as a full-time freelancer. He and I have worked on projects together off and on through the years. We've known each other at cons all through the years. Excited to work on Aberrant. And since the Aberrant Kickstarter is coming up, or actually is going on at the time this will be going live, that was a great time to bring him on and talk about his career and Aberrant and everything else that we can usually digress into because we're good at that. So thanks for coming on, Steve. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
We are good at digressions. That's kind of our thing here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, as you can tell from our intro, we're super polished and know exactly what we're doing with this whole thing.
Right. Absolutely.
So, I mean, I kind of talked about this already, but when we bring people on the show, we like to talk a lot about like how they got started. So, something, you know, I'd be curious what your origin story was. How did you kind of get into the tabletop RPG industry?
I kind of got into the industry almost by accident, really.
Really?
Yeah, I was, long time gamer. From the time I was in middle school, really. And in the early 90s, I was a huge Shadowrun fan, mm-hmm. As many of us were. Right. I was active on, I'm really going to date myself now. I was active on the old Genie Network, which was GE's online forums on my little dial-up modem.
I've never heard of that one. Like, I feel like I'm pretty well-versed in, like, early internet history. Like, I was a fairly early adopter, but, like, I've never heard of that one.
Yeah, this is pre-AOL. This is like Genie and CompuServe, I think, mm-hmm. were the two, you know, sort of commercial online networks.
Yeah.
General Electric had an online forum. And there was a little gaming hobby corner of it. FASA was active on Genie. And so they did the playtest for the second edition of Shadowrun on Genie.
Oh, wow.
And I was a keener, you know, I was that guy who was like, I will playtest all the things and I will give you volumes of feedback and, you know, I'm sure.
I will work for free.
Yes, I will do anything.
I can't tell you how many of our exalted writers came at it from that angle, where they're like, essentially just homebrewed and worked for free for long enough that we were like, can we publish that?
Can we start paying you? And that's pretty much what it came down to was I did so much feedback, you know, because of course, and I was totally that guy. Where it was not only feedback, but it was right, you know, here's like, you know, 2,000 words of stuff I've written, you know, that I think is cool, you know, sort of a thing. So I did enough of that, Shadowrun developer, Tom Dowd, was like, mm-hmm. basically like, can I pay you for some of this stuff? And you know, we'll use it. And oh, by the way, we have a hole in our, you know, writing schedule. You know, somebody needed to write an essay for the Magic source book. Do you want to do that? Would I? You know, like, you know, and you'll pay me for it. And you know, so I did that. So that just sort of snowballed into my writing more stuff for FASA. I did a few more freelance assignments. I did an adventure. I did, but then I got my first source book, that I pitched. It kind of, you know, just went from there. By the time, I got my first novel contract, with FASA, I was like, wow, this is like a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I could actually, you know, they keep paying me to do this, you know, maybe I could like, you know, make a go at this. And I hated my day job. I was working for a tech startup, that made, digital signal processing boards, which are a big deal to the, you know, innards of computers. Mm-hmm. I was the liberal arts guy, in the company. I was their, literally their first hire. I was the one who was capable of interfacing with humans.
That's part of why I got the job at Onyx Path.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
I would be mad about that, but it's not wrong.
You know, so I was, you know, the, you know, sort of marketing, sales,
right.
dealing with people guy.
Soft skills, they'd call it now.
Yes, indeed.
Soft skills.
And
I challenged those people to work retail for 2 weeks.
Right, right. I was frequently referred to as pretty smart for a liberal arts guy.
Oh.
You know, you know, because of course, real people, you know, real smart people have science degrees,
right?
You know, And so, yeah, was not feeling really valued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
and so I was like, okay, you know, I can do this writing thing. And so I did what they tell you not to do, and I quit my day job.
Yep.
And I was like, I'm gonna write and freelance full time, and I did, and you know, it ended up with, you know, a lot of lean periods, mm-hmm. you know, where I was like, wow, there are some people who will only promise to pay me for things.
Yeah.
You know, so there were some bumps, you know, along the road, but I quickly branched out from working primarily for FASA and freelanced for, you know, because when you're a freelancer, I freelanced for everybody, mm-hmm. you know, pretty much any company that would hire me, I would write for them. And so, you know, at some point or another, I worked for everyone. And in some cases it was only once or twice, and others that, you know, it proved to be a long-term relationship. But
right. Yeah. And actually, something that I didn't realize at the start of the project was that you actually did work quite a bit with White Wolf on the original Aberrants, first edition Aberrants.
I did.
I knew that you were a fan of it. I didn't realize you'd also actually had worked on it, and fairly a fair number of books too, from what I'm reading now.
Yeah, a pretty fair amount.
Are you doing your guest research during the podcast, Eddie?
No, I did it beforehand.
Okay, you said what you're reading right now. Right. I was like,
well,
it's
because it's literally in front of my face right now. That's why I'm reading it right now.
Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the amount of times that I've Googled somebody like while we're talking to them. So it's fine. There's no judgment.
Yes, but I'm supposed to be the wise old hand on this podcast. I'm supposed to know everything.
Yeah. It's true. That is your role.
You're right. You've worked on a ton of stuff. I mean, like, I went to RPG.net, and basically the website just keeps going and going and going and going and going. And so it's like, I completely, you know, I feel you in terms of, you know, you anybody who gives you work, you pick it up. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a very wide breadth of experience, which I find interesting because you've certainly developed, I don't know if it's an intentional or inadvertent reputation of being a guy who really knows superhero role-playing games.
As the superhero guy?
Yeah. and you have worked on, like, four or five of them. I mean, you have your own game, you have Mutants and Masterminds, you have Silver Age Sentinels, obviously Aberrant now. Is that something you intentionally cultivated, or is that like a niche you kind of just fell into?
Yeah, I think the unfolding theme is my tendency to kind of accidentally fall into things.
there are worse things to have.
I never particularly meant to be, you know, for superheroes to be my niche as such. I have always been a giant comics nerd. I mean, I was even before, you know, RPGs. I got started. I mean, when I got started, it was all Shadowrun and cyberpunk stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was all, you know, working on like fantasy stuff like Earth Dawn, and the like. There weren't a lot of superhero games that I had opportunities to write for as far as that sort of thing went. And it literally wasn't until I designed one that I had much opportunity to work on superhero games.
Okay.
So, you know, I kind of fell into that, you know, in a way.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. Because if I remember correctly, the time period, Hero was the only really big superhero game, and they were pretty insular.
Yeah.
It was like Steve Long writing pretty much everything for a while there.
Right. They had Steve Long. They didn't need anybody else.
Right. He'd do a book in like a week, you know?
Right. Right.
So I totally understand that. So those Mutants and Masterminds was the one you're referring to, you designed, right?
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, ironically, in some regards, Hero was kind of responsible for Mutants and Masterminds.
Oh, really?
Well, I had been doing some third-party Hero stuff, mm-hmm. Because they had sort of started licensing as far as that
right.
went.
Right. Yes.
And this is in the, you know, pre open game license mm-hmm. days. So, you know, the third party licensing was kind of novel. I had done a bit of that, and that had led to a larger project, which was to design a setting. And I did all the initial writing. I did basically a first draft, and unfortunately the project fell through, and it was one of those of, you know, well, it turns out we're not, you know, going to publish this thing.
Mm-hmm.
The rights of it reverted to me because, you know, they never paid me.
Right.
I had this setting book, and, you know, it became sort of my hobby project of, you know, I would keep tinkering with it. Cause now it was like, okay, well, since, you know, I can now do whatever I want with it, I'm just gonna, you know, like not compromise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I'm gonna take out all the parts that, you know, I was required to do, and plug in the things that I want. It was mostly sort of a, you know, hey, maybe I'll make a campaign out of this, you know, and I'll run it.
Right.
You know, sort of a thing. And so I tinkered with it a lot. And I had just started working with Green Ronin right around that time. Because you know, the D20 open license was a huge freelance market.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a couple of projects with them. We were talking and basically, you know, it was grist for the mill at that point. You know, everything was just like, you know, pitch us something,
right.
You know, because it was just wide open. You know, and I said, well, you know, I've got this, superhero setting source book. I have no idea what to do with it. Chris Premis was like, well, you know, let me take a look at it. You know, he's like, that's a little, you know, we're usually just looking for a D&D thing, but you know, let me take a look. And you know, he's like, it's good. He's like, I'll tell you what, if you want to design a D20 game that goes with it, we'll cut you a 2-book deal and we'll do the game core book and we'll do your setting book and we'll see how they go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was like, really? Like D20?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, for superhero games? Like, okay. Like I'll look.
Yeah.
Like I was not psyched about the idea.
Right.
You know, or I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to be an 11th level superhero. You know, and, you know, so I was like, all right, but, you know, I wanted to publish my setting book
right.
and, you know, it was, you know, so I was like, all right, I'll take a look. And I took apart the system resource document and I was like, how would I make this work? And, you know, I put together a draft proposal, that was a bunch of like, can I like take this whole thing out and do this instead? Mm-hmm. And, you know, can I change this, you know, sort of thing. That very, very quickly made it clear we couldn't use the D20 compatibility license.
Right.
That it would have to be the open game license because it was not going to be at all compatible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Chris was okay with that. And, you know, he was like, yeah, sure. You know, we'll give it a try. And so we did. And so, you know, the first edition of Mutants and Masterminds came along and Freedom City was its, you know, first setting book.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out people liked it. You know?
Still around today.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's in its, you know, third edition now.
And there have been a ton of setting books published for it too.
Crazy.
People using it for other things, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, because of the, you know, open game license, there's a lot of third party material out for mm-hmm. it. So, which is great.
Did the original one come out in like 01 or 02? Was it around that time?
02.
Okay. I had like a fever dream of like playing it in high school at some point, and that would have been,
yeah.
which timeline wise would make sense. I like feel like it's something mm-hmm. that we played at Sci-Fi Fantasy Club at some point. But we did short sessions of a lot of games.
That's
right. So I'm always like, wait, did I play that game? I think I did play that game, like, really shortly after it came out.
I actually worked on a third-party Mutants and Masterminds book. Because you're right, I remember that time period. It was around 2003 or 2004 I did this book. It's called Omlevex. It was with Cynthia Celeste Miller, and it was dual stated between Hero and Mutants and Masterminds. One of the last wave of those dual stated books. They're like the thing for like a couple of years, I remember.
And then
I think the Hero license. I don't remember what happened. I think Heroes just wasn't selling or something. But I remember we were talking about doing another version of it without the Hero stuff and blah blah. But Mutants and Masterminds is like, oh, let's also do this other game. It seems like it's pretty cool, and then it just exploded. It was that weird kind of intersection of D20 rise before the bubble burst, but also it was one of the few books, if I remember correctly, that was relatively self-contained in the D20. Am I remembering it right?
Yeah, it was. It was a standalone because a lot of, a lot of D20 stuff cleaved towards the D20 license, which meant, requires the player's handbook and, tended to be, sort of linked to D&D in one way or another. The 3.5 transition threw a lot of people for a loop.
Right, that's right.
As far as that went. Mutants and Masterminds didn't have that problem because it was self-contained. Mm-hmm. So it sort of had its own little ecosystem.
Totally, and I think that's probably a big part of it. So before I go down the road to the obvious superhero conclusion here, I do want to take a brief digression because
it's almost like we're on the Onyx path.
Right, yeah.
I know, right?
So at some point we're going to talk about Aberrant. I mean, let's just be clear about that. But before we do, let's talk about the other game we talk about a lot on this podcast, almost inadvertently, which is Blue Rose. Because once again,
it wasn't inadvertent. You just shoved it in there.
Well, in this case, it's now inadvertent. But I mean, for a while, there was this kind of, Bart Matthew had to clarify, this is not the Green Running podcast, because we're talking about a lot.
That's because I bring up Blue Rose all the time because I read romance novels and I read romantic fantasy novels and I like that kind of setting. So I'm always like bringing it up in like a, game people should play if they don't want to just punch guys for a while.
Oh, I agree.
Granted, I would say that most of our games lend themselves to various kinds of storytelling, but a lot of them are still very action or intrigue kind of focused.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So yeah, let's talk about Blue Rose. Talked about it with Joseph Carricker. We'll talk about it with Steve Kenson.
Yeah, totally. We talked about it with Joe about, to get your perspective on kind of how Blue Rose kind of came about, your input onto it, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Blue Rose actually was one of my first Green Ronin projects when I was on staff. I got hired by Green Ronin as a developer not long after Mutants and Masterminds because it was a success. And basically Green Ronin was like, so you want to, come on board and develop it as a full line. And I was like, yeah, the notion of steady employment at that point in my freelance career was
very attractive. I'm sure,
very attractive. I came on staff, do development. And one of the things, in addition to working on a second edition of Mutants and Masterminds and, sort of an expanded line for it, was Chris handed me this draft manuscript that John Sneed, who has done a lot of work with Onyx Path, had originally designed. In conjunction with the late lamented Alejandro Melchor, who had done a lot of the initial mechanics, as a basically sort of romantic fantasy setting, and there were a lot of really interesting concepts to it, but it was it needed some work. The mechanics in particular were in an odd sort of half state of compatible, but not, in terms of the D20 license. There were a lot of parts of it that needed some additional fleshing out. Jeremy Crawford, who of course is now the lead editor and D&D designer for Wizards of the Coast, was working as a freelance editor on the project at that time. And Jeremy and I started collaborating on the project, and we basically said, so, you know, this has a solid concept, but basically needs a rewrite in a lot of areas. And so Chris was amenable to that, and I, fresh off my, having done stuff with Mutants and Masterminds, said, maybe I can use some of the system stuff that I did for Mutants and Masterminds with this, and we can make it a standalone game. So that it has, because we're like, you know, we're looking to appeal to a particular audience here and saying, hey, you need to play D&D in order to do this.
Right.
Might not be as effective as we'd like. So
yeah, I don't think I would have liked Blue Rose as much if that was the case.
Right. You know, and so we were like, can we do some of these things and make it a standalone game? And Green Ravine was great. They were super great about letting me do, you know, try weird things. And so we did, basically. And we, you know, sort of rebuilt the game from the ground up. We did some different system elements to it. We incorporated the damage saving throw mechanic from Mutants and Masterminds into it to get rid of hit tracking points. We, you know, simplified a lot of the mechanics in a lot of ways. Jeremy and I were both strongly influenced by, we're both of an age where Mercedes Lackey's Magic's Price trilogy occupies a very special place in our hearts. you know, because a series of fantasy novels that had a queer protagonist was almost unheard of at that time when we were teenagers, basically. And so we also made a point of, not to put too fine a point on it, queering it up, you know, as far as, you know, adding a lot of, a lot more, you know, sort of queer diversity to the setting and incorporating it into the setting's mythology and, looking at what, you know, that meant for its culture and all of that. It was an interesting project. And it was, again, you know, it was another one of those things that I didn't set out to do. It sort of, you know, landed on my desk and, you know, was an interesting opportunity. So far as that went. And we also had the good fortune of working with the amazingly talented Stephanie Pumin-Law, who at the time was also freelancing as an artist. And she did these gorgeous concept covers, and the like that we were able to work off of. So, it turned out to be a really interesting project, you know, in the end. I think it found a small audience, but you know, never really grew much beyond that because there was so much going on at that point in publishing. And truth be told, it didn't get an especially lavish treatment when Green Ronin first did it. It was a black and white soft cover. Mm-hmm. It did have that gorgeous cover, but you know, Green Ronin was willing to take some risks, but to a point,
right?
You know,
right? So I think that it had a bit of a sort of cult following, you know, but it wasn't really a huge breakout success.
I do remember at the time it was a cult following. Is like certainly a lot of it was, you know, oh hey, here's it was that time period where more openly queer content was showing up in tabletop role-playing games. But also separately, I remember a lot of people talking to us like, here's a way to kind of redo D&D without actually doing D&D. Because you, yes. you made so many changes, it was a D&D-ish experience. And I know a few people have pointed to that being one of the inspirations for ultimately what became the retro clone movement of people trying to basically redo different versions and new editions of D&D or different takes on D&D while using the OGL. So, I mean, it's definitely one of those games that wasn't, sounds like it wasn't a huge sales driver at the time, but has since made a pretty big stamp on the industry from a design perspective, certainly.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think Blue Rose did well enough. I mean, because we did more stuff for it, but it did have a surprising footprint in terms of people's reactions to its game system. You know, we honestly expected in some regards a bigger reaction to its setting content. And there definitely was a segment of people who were super interested in the way it handled the sort of core elements of the D20 game, as far as that went. That's what ended up being, in fact, why Green Ronin ended up doing the whole True 20 system.
Right, because it came from Blue Rose.
It was basically taking Blue Rose's core game and making it a setting independent sort of game system.
Absolutely. So it's always fascinating to me to kind of, because when you're in a moment, you never think about what the impact of what you're working on is going to have. But it's always weird to kind of look back and go, oh, hey, this is where it landed. And it never quite lands, I think, the way you think it will. And sometimes it's for the better. And sometimes it's, you know, oh, that could have gone better than I thought, you know. but I mean, yeah, it's kind of a nice segue. I mean, we're talking a little bit about how you're expecting more kind of outlash or response to the queer content that didn't really happen. Whereas Aberrant, it seemed like initially there was a very divided approach to that. I mean, you guys both explained to me the Divis Mal has arms joke, so I'll let you kind of explain that because it helped me to understand it too.
Yeah, I finally looked it up the other day and I was like, oh.
Yeah. I remember when I first started, my first introduction to Aberrant was right after Craig Blackwelder got named developer. And we were at Gen Con, and introduced myself to Craig and, you know, was basically pitching, you know, myself, you know, for freelance work. And, you know, saying, hey, you've got a superhero game. I'm totally into that, you know, sort of a thing. And we were talking about it. And he was giving me a little sense of some of his plans and his thoughts. And I distinctly remember him telling me about the decision to out Divis Mal basically in the game, because I remember he held up the cover of Aberrant and, you know, pointed to the picture of Divis Mal on it and is like, look at this queen. like, you know, how can he not be?
Right.
You know? I mean, he's such an over-the-top drama queen, you know, like, you know, it was done, you know, fairly matter-of-factly. But I do recall, you know, there was, you know, and so basically there was the online, you know, forum post that is entitled, you know, Divis Mal is gay, all caps, you know, multiple WTF. Question marks,
yeah.
You know, sort of a thing. Yeah, right, WTF, right. You know. You know, and, you know, which, of course, almost immediately engendered, you know, the reaction of, you know, wait, Divis Mal has arms? you know, right. Like you're pointing out, like, you pick any characteristic of a person, you know,
his brown hair. Oh my God! You know, yeah.
Right? Heavens, yeah. He has bilateral symmetry. You know, I mean, you know, sort of a thing where people were mocking the notion that you should be shocked. You know that, you know, my gods, queer people exist. You know,
oh no, my bubble.
Right. Exactly. and it, you know, it was intruding upon the classic. You know, well, what is the reason, you know, that Divismal is gay? Right. And it's like, well, I don't know. What's the reason I'm gay?
Right. <You know?
laughs> Right, yeah.
What's my narrative driver?
Yeah, that's so frustrating. And that's one of those things where, like, you know, we try to make pretty inclusive products, I would say. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work on Exalted, Chronicles of Darkness, whatever, the lines I'm in charge of. And Eddie's even slipped some stuff into Pugmire, you know? Mm-hmm. That's kind of awesome. But, like, we, you know, kind of put it out there everywhere. And there's always that one person who's like, but why do you have to shove it in my face? And it's like, because people exist in this world. Y'all, like, calm down. Like,
right.
Like, every time that we put, like, a non-binary character or a trans character or a gay character or whatever in one of our games, someone's always like, but they put politics into it. And it's like, no. We put people that exist in the world
yeah.
into this game. Like, just right. because you think that them existing is a political thing, it's not. Like, fighting for their rights is a political thing, but just them existing, that's just a thing. It's just how the world is. So right. yeah, it's a frustrating thing, and I like that even back when Aberrant was released, people were actively pointing out how ridiculous it was. Because mm-hmm. I feel like that's more yeah. common now, and mm-hmm. I feel like when Aberrant was released, it wasn't as common to be like, no, you're dumb. Just as a like off-the-cuff reaction when someone says something like that.
Right.
So that's actually, you know, it is heartening.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is it became kind of a joke more than an issue.
No, totally. Exactly. Like, I had heard Ian and folks reference it a few times before I looked it up, and I was like, oh, okay, that's the joke.
Right. And it was interesting, like, from my perspective is because, again, I mean, you know, because I was so steeped in that, and I was a White Wolf fan beforehand. So to me, it was, I missed the joke because I didn't realize that anyone would be potentially offended by it. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is like, of course, I mean, why wouldn't there be, you know, in fact, in my circle, there were more jokes with the fact that he was Irish than the fact that he was gay. So now having lived in Ireland, I have a very complex relationship with Divismal right now. Mm. But I mean, so it's fascinating to me how people look at a property and pull away from it different things. But I know it's definitely one of the things when I know Rich talked about he wanted to do another edition of Aberrant. I mean, your name was like, at the top of Rich's list like right away for lots of reasons. And I remember when we decided to put the team together of me, you, and Ian, we just kind of were all on the same page, you know, in terms of a lot of that stuff. I mean, really, most of our conversations mm-hmm. were about how do we get the story path mechanics right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true.
But I mean, so what we did with Aberrant was a little different. I want to kind of, for the audience's sake, usually when we do a book, we have someone come in, like you mentioned, as a developer, and they kind of handle all the logistics, the project management side of things. And then we hire other people to write, and maybe the developer will also write on it. But generally, mm-hmm. they're going to kind of project manage it. And with this, we decided something different. And we have you now, I believe the title we settled on was lead writer, lead designer, where you did a lot of the writing and design of the book. And Ian was there in what would normally be the creative side of the line developer role, where it's like, here's what the Aberrant mm-hmm. world needs, here's how I envision Aberrant going, and here's how it ties to the larger Trinity continuum. And I was doing the actual just, okay, guys, here's the deadlines, here's where your drafts are due, let me mm-hmm. go through and consolidate all the stuff. How was that experience for you?
It was good. I really appreciated being able to coordinate those things that way, because, you know, as we talked early on in the project, I got pretty burnt out on mm-hmm. development. You know, I did it for whatever it was, 7-8 years, you know, right. at Green Ronin. You know, it was one of those things of I got into the industry in order to write and design. Mm-hmm. And you know, it eventually, you know, started to become more and more about project management, and you know, that's not what I set out to do.
Right.
So,
right.
I really wanted to focus on the writing and design aspects of it, and you know, our setup for Aberrant was great in that it really allowed me to do that and to still have input in the process without necessarily having to, you know, manage things. So I was super happy with it.
I think it worked great too, because it allowed Ian to really focus on saying, okay, here's where it all fits in and how it all connects. Because for those who haven't yet checked out the Kickstarter, this is in a lot of ways a reboot. Because during the futuristic timeline of Aberyn is now 10 years in our past.
we decided funny when that happens.
Yeah, right. It's like the ancient days of 2008, you know. We knew we were going to have to reboot it. And so we intentionally came into it with kind of some things we wanted to keep that was core to Aberyn, but also some things that changed. And I'm trying to remember, the fireman staying alive was a big one. Was that you or was that Ian? I don't remember.
I think that was me initially.
Okay.
But I'm not sure, because there was a lot of collaboration, especially in the early concept stages of things. I do remember, the whole treatment of the fireman and his sort of symbolic role in the setting was one of the really very early things that we talked about.
Mm-hmm. Because one of the things is we talked about is changing the tone, because Craig would occasionally go online and talk about how it wasn't really a superhero game. And I think Rich really felt like, no, it's a superhero game. Let's lean into that a bit more. And I remember during the conversation, you were very excited about the idea of by having Fireman actually die in Aberyn this time around. We not only stop the arc of the corruption of Superman kind of thing, but also it gives the game a focus, a sense of, you know, okay, here's an actual literal sacrifice. Sacrifice is one of the themes of the Trinity, and here's one of the literal sacrifice we could point to and say, here's something characters can aspire to. I thought that was a really, really strong moment that we could build on.
Yeah, I really liked that a lot. I think that the first edition of Aberyn was very informed by the sort of deconstructionist trend in superheroes and superhero comics in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a certain quality of taking a lot of the tropes of superheroes and comics and essentially rendering them as sort of absurdist.
Right.
As far as that went.
Yeah, Dark Knight Returns, Watchmen, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. There was a certain, you know, very late 90s cynicism to it all as far as that went. And I think that the new edition of Aberyn is much more informed by the sort what I guess we could call sort of the cinematic realism trend in superheroes, where, you know, the huge difference is now, instead of just the comic books, there's a huge audience whose experience with superheroes is watching real people play superheroes on the big screen.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And having to, you know, look good in the costumes and, you know, sort of a little bit more of a sense of what real superheroes or real people with superpowers would be like in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Aberyn draws more on that now. It still takes a certain amount of, you know, hey, this comic book thing would not fly in the real world.
Right.
Approach, but I think it's definitely much more informed by, you know, sort of a cinematic sense of superheroes.
I completely agree. And I know one of the pieces that you talked about when you were talking to us about that kind of cinematic approach is the role media has. Because I think we all agreed that one of the things that made Aberyn unique was the role that the media had on superheroes and making them celebrities as opposed to outcasts. But obviously, we're not in a world where a single cable network is a realistic approach to that. You know, we're into streaming social media. So can you talk a bit more about what your thoughts were in terms of like how to approach this new media approach and how to bring that to Aberyn?
Yeah, so that is one of the biggest changes between the first edition of Aberrant and its interpretation, because in many ways the first edition of Aberrant was really about celebrities and celebrity culture,
right? Mm-hmm.
And you know what it means to have tremendous fame suddenly thrust upon you, and the new edition of Aberrant in a lot of regards has some of those elements to it. But is also just about how, you know, through social media and through greater interconnectedness, how we, you know, and I mean by we, like culture, mm-hmm. you know, around the world, reacts to things and to events, and how quickly those reactions can set things in motion. So far as that goes, I mean, I remember when in the first edition of Aberrant, there's in one of the source books talking about culture and the like, and talking about the opnet, the author essentially invents Netflix,
mm-hmm.
And you know, and talks about the whole notion, you know, at the time of, you know, in the future, you know, there will be limitless streaming video and. You know, and it was science fiction,
right?
You know, and now, you know, we can't, you know, point to that in Aberrant as, you know, an astounding achievement. you know, instead we have to, you know, adapt to, you know, what exists. So yeah, we make a lot more use of the notion of social media, and, the notion of influencers,
mm-hmm.
In particular, you know, because the Novas are just born social media influencers, because they automatically have this cachet to them.
Mm-hmm.
So really all they have to do is decide they want the platform that they're being handed. And that, you know, they want to, you know, talk to the people who are going to hang on their every word and action, in a much more interactive way than, first edition was really kind of in many ways about dealing with the paparazzi,
right?
You know, mm-hmm. you know, of how do you deal with the sort of intrusiveness of everybody wants to know, you know, everything about you. And second edition is much more about a conversation. I mean, you know, because you have this power, you know, and again, Aberrant's all about power and right. what do you do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, you know, the sort of soft powers, you know, of the Novas is that they're hugely influential.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everything they say and do, you know, affects people and whether they want it to or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes, you know, what do you do with that when you're handed it?
Right. You have to manage your brand as well as your powers on some level.
Right. Exactly.
That's kind of cool. I like that.
It is.
I haven't read Aberrant yet, so I'm like completely in the dark on all this. So I'm just, if anybody's wondering why Dixie's quiet on this one, it's because I haven't seen the manuscript for Aberrant yet. Like all I've seen of Aberrant is the comic we're releasing. So that's about where my knowledge base is.
Fair enough, though. I mean, it's... In a lot of ways, because it's a reboot, it's a project that's been around for a long time. I mean, we're kind of having to reintroduce it to a lot of people. And also, like you say, Steve, the environment that it's launching in, I mean, there's still some deconstructionalism happening, but it's very specific now. Nowadays, you know, there's kind of been, that, like you said, the trend back towards that melding of Silver Age sensibility with quasi-realism. So, I mean, we're basically having to start from scratch, even though we do have this long established fan base. There are going to be people who are going to be like, oh, it's not quite what I expect, or, you know, or they'll love it even more than what originally happens. I talked to a few people in the UK, actually, when we were at UK Games Expo, who were like, you know, tell me about their game. And they were like, well, is there going to be this? You know? And so I think just going to be that excitement there. But yeah, to a lot of people, it's going to be brand new. And so, I mean, I think it's going to be really cool to see how people react to that.
Yeah, I think so too.
And related to that, since you're building on an existing engine, you're building on the existing StoryPath engine, what were some of the design challenges in making this book?
Well, the key thing with Aberrant, like most superhero games, is its breadth in terms of you know, what characters can do. You know, as superhero games, by their very nature, have to have a certain universality to them because there's just such a broad range of powers and effects, and you have to account for just a ton of stuff. You know, Aberrant has a slight advantage in that, you know, it has a very clear definition. You know, Novas all share a common origin and their common power mechanics. So it's not like we, you know, on top of everything else, had to account for, you know, how to, you know, do magic and how to do, you know, all of the other, you know, weirdness that ends
gods
up
and
in,
aliens,
you know, superheroes, right? Gods and aliens and, you know, the whole nine yards. But nonetheless, you know, there's just a tremendous range of powers. One of the big fun elements of superheroes and superhero settings is that coming up with your own theme and your power set and all of that sort of a thing, and having a wide range of characters. So that definitely required looking at, you know, a way to offer a broad menu of options so far as character building was concerned. Previously, StoryPath had been focused on making those menu options fairly simple. In this case, they were a bit more complex. And I think we found a good, you know, sort of happy medium as far as that goes, in terms of making the upfront choices still reasonably straightforward. But there's a fair amount of complexity on the back end as far as that goes.
Right. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think we all kind of knew going into that was going to be a challenge, particularly because the previous edition kind of solved that problem by just throwing more dice at the issue, which...
The Shadowrun solution.
Right.
I remember it well.
And it's funny because, like, there are certainly people who have this weird retroactive affection for buckets of dice. And I've kind of talked with a few of them and, like, going, I'm sure you look at it fondly now, but I'm sure at the time it was not that great. We were rolling 75 dice and figuring out which of them have 8 or higher. I mean, it's a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
Luckily, now we have dice rolling apps. So
that is true.
You know, when you are playing Exalted or Shadowrun or whatever, you can figure out a dice rolling app. Because I have talked to folks about playing Exalted, and I'm like, I'm not sure I could have done it without Onyx Dice.
Yeah.
But now we have that app, and I can actually roll 100 dice at one time, and it will tell me if I succeeded.
That's true. That makes things a lot easier. But we did move away from that. I mean, you know, we did build more reliance on what Trinity and StoryPath already established with enhancements and complications and tiers and whatnot, so that way we could reduce the amount of dice that come into it.
Right. Plus, we had scale.
Right.
So, which hugely helped.
Oh yeah, scale solved frankly a lot of problems. I know, like, for unrelated, but when we were working on They Came From Deep to Sea, I addressed it as kind of the Godzilla problem. Is like, you have to have in a B movie the scene where the army's shooting at the giant monster and it's like, guns don't work. You know, and scale solved that problem perfectly. Whereas other games, that's kind of a clunkier result. So.
Yeah,
I saw a lot of that synergy happening when you were working on Aberrant. It seemed like when I was going through drafts, it's constantly like, "Oh, that's very clever. Or, that's really cool." And like negative scale, for example, the idea that you went backwards through scale to get to that Ant-Man style,
right?
So, I mean, is there anything else that we haven't talked about yet that you really were excited about to work on with Aberrant?
I was really excited, in addition to the design challenges, to work with, you know, a lot of the characters and, you know, just factions and story of Aberrant, because I always found it very compelling. One of the things that I've liked most about Aberrant, including running my own, you know, Aberrant game, was that Aberrant does nicely sidestep one of the limitations of comic book style superheroes, which is that comic book style superheroes are basically all about the status quo.
Right.
You know, ultimately they're about, you know, preventing the bad guys from, you know, changing the world in bad ways.
Right.
You know, I mean, the villains have an evil plan and the hero's job is to stop them. And otherwise, you know, that's, you know, the heroes are just meant to, you know, kind of keep everything on an even keel. Aberrant, because, you know, it isn't, attached to, you know, a comic book IP that is, has a vested interest in maintaining a status quo. Aberrant can instead say, hey, you have tremendous power. You can change the world. How do you want to do it? And, you know, and that is just a, such a fantastic well of opportunities for interesting stories, because you can do a tremendous amount with both how difficult and how inadvertently easy it is to change the world, especially when you have tremendous power. And the sort of, you know, responsibility that, that falls upon you, whether, again, whether you want it or not, because of that power. That's just, that's such a rich vein, to mine. You know, and I had, tremendous fun, you know, playing with it, in my own games and just looking at the different, the way the different factions in the setting approach power and their goals and, you know, is it, you know, is it good to, you know, work with a group that wants to harness your power for the greater good? You know, are you in the process giving away your decision-making power, you know, because you just can't handle the burden of responsibility and it's easier to have somebody tell you, yeah, this will be good. Right. Go do that. You know, there's a lot of interesting nuance in that.
Absolutely. And because it's set in the near future, it's recognizable enough to our world that you feel like there's this thing, this is injustice or this problem I want to change in our world now that you could address. But also because in the future, if you make changes, it doesn't, it will deform what the world looks like, but it's you have a chance to play that out a bit more. Whereas, like you say, with like the big superhero comic book universe, that's kind of ultimately reset to a world we recognize.
I mean, and because of the nature of their publishing and their audience, they have to do that.
Whereas,
you know, but Aberrant doesn't.
And in fact, you know, because it ties into the larger continuum, it has to go in a certain different direction. Because it ultimately has to have the Aberrant core and lead into Aeon. You're right. I think it's very cool that we had that freeing power. And I'm so excited to hear that you were embracing that and bringing that into the book. Because I think it's where, you're right, it's where Aberrant really shines.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it casts an interesting element on a lot of the factions in Aberrant in that there's not – I mean, there are definitely antagonists and adversaries in Aberrant. But there's very little, you know, sort of super villainy as such.
No, yeah, it's basically all of the factions are basically playable. So whichever path you choose or your Chronicles has focus on, then that other group becomes your default antagonist as opposed to, you write that very clear line of we are now heroes and you are now villains.
Right.
Sweet. So we're getting close to time. Is there anything else that you're working on Onyx Path related or not that you kind of want to promote and talk about a bit?
Let's see. I just released a source book for Icon's Superpowered Role-Playing, one of my other superhero games, called Rogues, which is a collection of villains, is just a, you know, fun collection of adversaries. You know, I say that, you know, especially for mainstream superhero games, that, you know, basically villains are all walking plot hooks, you know, because like we were talking about, you know, the game is ultimately about the villain has an evil plan and you have to stop them. So, you know, villain books are also basically, you know, just sort of adventure books in and of themselves. So that just released last week and is out on DriveThru. What else? Expanse has been out only a short while from Green Ronin, although it seems like forever in editorial and production time. Yep. But it's still relatively new. I know backers from the Kickstarter are getting their copies and it's finding its way out into stores and all of that. Mm-hmm. So, that's a great new project that I'm really looking forward to more people having a chance to dig into.
Sweet. Where, if people want to talk with you about Aberrant or any of the other projects you work on, where will they find you online?
So folks can find my website at stevekenson.com. I am on Twitter at S Kenson, K-E-N-S-O-N. Probably the social media that I'm most active on. I'm on Facebook as well. And I've got an author page on Facebook where I do news and announcements and whatnot. I think those are the most accessible means of finding me. If people are looking for selfies, they can track me down on Instagram. But other than that, there's not much to see there.
I know my poor Instagram account is languishing too. I understand.
Mine is almost all my roommate's cats now. Mm-hmm. So people are going to be really sad if I don't live here anymore. Because I've been producing quality cat content for the past year.
I know.
It's only because they're somebody else's cats.
You have to invest in some quality cats of your own.
I mean, yeah, eventually. But for right now, it's I'll just keep mooching off what should rightfully be my roommate Laura's social media cred. but she doesn't post to Instagram all that often. So
someone's got to pick up the
slack. I get to do it.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us, Steve. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah, this is fun.
And we're back.
So, I mean, me and you never left, Eddie. I don't understand why you didn't say we're back. Only Matthew's technically back.
Maybe I'm the one that never went away.
You were just hanging out in an empty room while we went and interviewed Steve.
Yeah, maybe the two of you caught the bus. I imagine you probably caught the bus to see Steve and interview him. I can't imagine you would have done it any other way. Where would you have gone to do so? I think Kalamazoo. I've always liked the place name Kalamazoo. It always brings a smile to my face when I see it in an airport. Never been. I don't know if there's many reasons to be there, other than, of course, to interview Steve Kenson, who doesn't live in Kalamazoo. But he was passing through at the time, and so hence the interview that you've just listened to, I guess.
What happened there? What?
I feel like everybody just hearing what makes Matthew a good storyteller.
He
can just talk and have no idea where he's going with it.
I've been trapped in this room alone for a very long time. One of my favorite RPGs, other than Aberrant, of course, is The Extraordinary Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is a James Wallace game, which is more of, I guess, a storytelling game than an RPG. But it was my first introduction, I guess, to that kind of game, and I love it. So, yes, I am well practiced in spooling off absolute nonsense.
According to Google Maps, a bus ride to Kalamazoo from where I live would be 20 hours and 34 minutes.
That's not a long journey in American terms, is it?
It's down the road.
I would say anything over about, 7 or 8 is when we start going And for Eddie, it would be 18 hours, 52 minutes.
Oh, okay. Ha. you will stop saying ha when you arrive in Kalamazoo, that's for sure.
So
being an American bus for 18 hours, no, that's a soul crushing experience.
That sounds like my nightmare. I do not want to do that. Also, part of your journey would involve MARTA, according to that, Eddie. So sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So yeah, MARTA's the airport's better than I can do.
That was a fun interview. I have listened to it, of course.
Of course.
What was your favorite part?
The introduction. I thought Eddie handled it masterfully. But Steve as well was an absolutely delightful guest, really had a lot to say. And, you know, I've very much enjoyed hearing the stories behind Divis Mal.
Have arms.
One of the iconic characters of Aberrant. And, of course, one of the, I guess, very first out gay characters presented in an RPG, really, in a modern RPG. And yeah, it was a really interesting interview. Sad I couldn't be there, but damn it, I'll be there for the next one.
One of the things that I didn't get a chance to talk about in the interview, also because it's a bit awkward at the time, not for Steve, but for me, is due to the way we made the book, I ended up having to write the comic scripts for the actual book itself. We got Paul Jenkins to do our wonderful webcomic that's ongoing now, but Rich wanted to do comic strips in lieu of fiction for each of the chapters. And so it's a new process and involved a heavy integration with art. So I said, what does it make sense for me internally to kind of do that? Mm-hmm. And one of the scripts I pitched, Rich said, no, we don't want to do that. Instead, I want you to do something with Divis Mal. And I'm like, oh. And so Steve had been reading all the scripts along with Ian, and they're putting their two cents in. But then now it's like, now I have to write a script with Divis Mal, which I know is Steve's favorite character. I'm like, oh man. So I did write a script, which I'm not going to spoil, but it does involve his relationship with Maxwell Mercer, which is an ongoing thread throughout all of the Trinity games. And Steve was like, you know, I really love this. I mean, he had some great thoughts on how to. But he really, really enjoyed that. And I was like, oh, thank you. Because I remember Steve going, yeah, but also this is kind of crap. Because it would have been valid if he'd been like, you know, the characters were this way. And I'm like, okay, cool, I'll make that happen. But I was a little nervous, but he really liked it. So I was happy about that.
I mean, it's interesting because there's a difference between when you're writing a favorite character for like groups of fans. Because you're kind of like, well, mm-hmm. I can still play with it. Like, I understand what fans like. But I feel like if, like, you, Eddie, had asked me to write, like, Murrah Pug in Pugmire, I would have been like, that's your dog. Like, I don't understand what to do. Like, I'm going to screw this up. Because, like, when it becomes personal, when it's, like, one of your coworkers or one of your friends' favorite characters, you're like, I really don't want to mess this up for them. Because, you know, you don't want to disappoint your friends. So, yeah.
I actually had that experience. Joe Carricker, his kitty, Iliad, passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked if he could write about Iliad for his story for Monarchy's Mouth. And I was like, okay, cool. And then we started talking a little bit about the character. And he's like, actually, I kind of want to be a jerk. And I was like, you know, I've not had many people put their animals in. It's like, yeah, no, my animal's just a bastard. So I was like, can I roll with this? And he's like, oh yeah, sure. So we actually talked. And that's why Ilya got kind of promoted to being a diplomat for Pugmire. And he's been an antagonist I've used off and on in a few projects now because he's such a great character. Because Joe really loves that kind of vizier manipulative archetype.
Right.
And I was like, that's exactly what a cat ambassador for Pugmire would be. And so every once in a while I'm working on a project, I'll send him like a snippet or an audio file or something of Delving Iliad. He's like, oh, it's my baby. And I was like, oh, thank you. Because again, it's that, I mean, it's my property and he respects that, but also it was his baby. And I want to make sure that, you know, again, I'm respectful of that.
Yeah. If I ever put Bebop in anything, he's going to be a dick. So
there we go. I'll have to change the name though.
The worst cat.
He is the worst cat.
Yeah, I think I referenced him in one of our projects that's subject to change based on backers. But there is someone named, I think, BB. Because that's a real name.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. I can name a cat BB. Right. And we call him BB all the time. So
that works out well?
Yeah.
But yeah, so...
now we're talking about Pugmire. That's relatable to Steve Kenson.
You've just been speaking to Steve Kenson about Aberrant for an hour. We can talk about Pugmire for a little while.
Hi, Steve. I have to go back to Pugmire in a bit. But no, I mean, yeah, it was definitely. I mean, there was obvious reasons to interview Steve now because of the Aberrant Kickstarter and his heavy role in that. But also, I mean. Like you said, Dixie, I mean, he's just a really interesting guy. And it's someone I've been wanting to get in the pathcast for quite a while now because he's just done so much. And not in the sheer volume way, but also he's very passionate about some of his projects he's worked on. I mean, you know, obviously, we all work on projects like, cool, here's some money. I'll do a thing well and hand it over. And that's kind of your emotional investment with it. But sometimes, as a freelancer, you get those projects you're really tied to. And so having him talk about things like Mutants and Masterminds and Blue Rose, which is, we joked about it, but I mean, it is kind of a thing we talk about a lot because it's a unique approach to gaming that hasn't really been done much since.
Mm-hmm.
And so having him talk about those kinds of stuff, it was just as much interesting as going into what we're doing with Aberyn.
Totally. Also, yay, Aberyn Kickstarter!
Aberyn Kickstarter, yes. So I can't, since I've already dated this, I can confirm that we can't tell you how it's doing right now because I'm assuming it's already funded and has made $1 million.
Yep.
It's reasonable.
It's our first $5 million RPG.
I think we're on. Let's play a game. Which one of us is going to be closest? I don't even know what the funding target's going to be on this one. So you'll go for $1 million. You'll go for $1 million, Eddie.
The actual funding target is 40K. So
all right,
keep that in mind if you want to play the game.
Okay, so as of time of upload, where do you think we'll be, Eddie?
I'm going to say 50K.
50K. Okay, Dixie?
Let's see. This goes up 3 days after it goes live. Yep. See, I was going to say 50, but now I'm having a hem and haw.
Go for 50,001.
The price is right method.
Like, I was going to say, you don't want to go over, so I'm thinking about bidding $1.
Okay.
So anything under 50K, I win.
In that case, I'm going to go for 49,999.
Okay.
You both suck.
$1. One person has contributed $1 to Aberyn.
Something went horribly wrong with the launch of this Kickstarter.
Oh my God.
I am honestly assuming it's somewhere between 35 and 50. Just because there's been so much buildup for this project. We've had so many fans coming out of the woodwork and talking about it. And like, it's one of those projects that whenever we talk about it, I'm always kind of like, it's weird because until I started working for Onyx Path, I had never heard of this game. But every time I turn around, someone's like, that was my favorite game. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, let's look at this edition, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, digression, but it is always weird to find something that's new to you that has a passionate fan base. Because it's like, it's a bit of the, where has this been, you know, all my life kind of thing, you know, it's like, you know, but it's always really cool because then it's new to you. And usually in those kinds of situations, people are excited to tell you all about it. So you don't learn about this whole new thing that you never knew about before. So,
yeah. Are you familiar with the XKCD's 1 in 10,000?
Yes.
Comic? Yeah. That's like what I always think when I see one of my friends is discovering something that I've liked for a long time. Like, I'm always just like, congratulations, you're one of today's lucky 10,000. Because I think it was last night on Facebook, I saw one of my friends who was watching Tucker and Dale versus Evil and was like, why did no one tell me about this movie? And I'm like, I feel like I talk about that movie every time I watch it. And I've seen it several times. But congratulations, now you've seen it. So yeah.
There you go. Absolutely. That's always fun. So hopefully even people who are brand new to the Aberrant excitement, we'll check in and see what's available and what. Frankly, I think it's a pretty cool take on superheroes as a whole.
Yeah, totally.
So, if people want to talk to us about Aberrant or indeed anything else, Matthew, where would they find you?
They can contact me at matthewdawkins.com. We will also be having many videos related to Aberrant going up on our YouTube channel, maybe even our Twitch channel. Keep tuned for that. And we always encourage people to comment on our videos because it tells us what you like, and engagement is always fun.
And Dixie?
You can find me at dixiecochran.com. You can find me at dixiecyanide on most social media. You can find me watching the Aberrant Kickstarter because whenever we launch a Kickstarter, I spend way too long just staring at it. You know, all that kind of stuff.
And you can find me on Twitter at Eddie Fate, EDDYFATE. That's also the name of my website. You can find me on Facebook at Eddie Web Writer. And also, I didn't mention this during our last week's episode, but another episode of my Extra Credits series went up recently. It's talking about bleed and psychological transference in games. So if you're curious about why you get really excited when your character wins in a game, why not check it out on Extra Credits on YouTube. And you can also find all of us at theonyxpath.com. We hang around the forums of the Onyx Path, the Onyx Path Facebook group, Onyx Path Twitter. So definitely, if you have thoughts about the podcast, about us in particular, as long as they're constructive as respectful as we talked about last week, find us any of those places. And as always, many worlds, one podcast.